Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond.
What's up with it, John? Man, don't change that sound. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that down. Wiggling.
Yeah, this is Cassidy, the hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
What it ain't, what it do. Chili Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West West, y'all.
Why you wanna put the blame on me?
Wasn't greener, now you missing me. But you have some bitches laughing while you dissing me. Nah, look, I'm gone with the wind. Could've been, did you dirty, throw this pussy to your best friend. I ain't tripping, I'm just focused on my goals. Stacking up the dough and laughing at them silly hoes. And your mama stay playing both sides. Lying for you even when she see the tears in my eyes. Look, I ain't talking to that bitch. I ain't fucking with your kids and I'm done with the blended shit. I stay down loyal 10 toes. And you kept playing me with them side hoes. Then you tried to put the blame on me. Tried to do me dirty, run a game on me.
Why you wanna put the blame on me?
You are now tuned in to episode 515 of Off the Cuff Radio. I'm your host, King Eric, the Media Assassin, and this show is sponsored by Cocaine's Buddy Boy Entertainment. Fleetwood and the Top Pickers, Da Vinci Clothing, Jesse Boutique, Core Financial, Screwball Radio. You can catch that tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 Pacific, 8 Central Time. Got my host T-Max with the facts of the building. What it is, my brother?
What's going on, man? Another fly, fresh evening with OTC Radio. That's our co-host, Mr. Sandman. Chilla, it is an all-star array of everything awesome and extraordinary, and we are live and direct tonight once again to give you the most in-depth, dope, and essential discussion of all things hip-hop and entertainment. We're ready to do it. We're ready to do it.
Ready to get it going down, man. And our guest tonight, he's been really on the grind ever since we had her on in 2017. She has been really busy building her brand, putting out documentaries, putting out new content, shooting new videos. She's been heavily on the scene. You can catch her performing recently at Texas at the festival this past year. And she's back with us to chop it up and tell us her story, what she's been going on lately, give us some more insights as we, you know, we've grown since 2017 to a bigger audience about her story, her music, her grind. Let's all welcome our good friend, SKJ. What it is?
Yeah.
Hey, how are you?
What's going on?
How you
Welcome
doing?
Back with us.
Hey, I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Yes, yes. Great to have you back on. So it's like King said, obviously you've been a busy Wonder Woman of all things, illustrious and incredible, and entertaining enormous. I mean, tell us what's been going on.
You know, just basically like everybody else, just out here grinding, putting out content, dropping songs, drop the album, and, you know, just making it happen one day at a time.
Word.
And you know what, though? I want to put this out, too. I forgot to put this as a part of the intro. And this is for those who want to get in and let it be known that she, SKJ, is one of the original content creators on YouTube, going back to Hustle Girl Entertainment in 2007. She's been on curve, ahead of the curve before even we thought about it. So we had to put that out there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was crazy. Yeah.
In terms of, like, King
said,
you know, SK. Yeah. Oh, go ahead, King. Go ahead.
Yeah, because I was going to say, because I want to ask, it ties into my question. Like, you see a lot of rappers coming into the lane, into the podcast game, but you were a part of the original content creators, and because you was doing this before anybody ever thought about that.
Yeah, you know, I was doing a lot of different things. You know, like I always tell people, I just kind of grew up in the industry, and growing up within the music industry, you wear different hats. So, you know, of course I'm a rapper and I do the music, and then I do a lot of behind the scenes dealing with, you know, like I was doing interviews. I had traveled and did a documentary. You know, I was doing a lot of stuff. I think we put things out.
Definitely. And when you look at how, like King said, that you were one of the, you know, original podcasts, and you were on that road, being ahead of the curve, swerving on everybody before it became a thing, what was it like in terms of you being so prescient in terms of, you know, being in a lane that a lot of people now are doing in abundance, which you were one of the pioneers of? Or what was your goal when you first started out doing it?
My whole thing was just basically back then was to get content and be creative and do things that other people wasn't doing. And, you know, that's how that really came about. I wanted to still do music, but I wanted to kind of be behind the scenes back then at that time.
Definitely. And pretty much from where you've seen it, from where you... Oh, mm-hmm. Go ahead, King.
Yeah, I was saying, so let's go back to your humble beginnings. Like, tell us where you're from.
I'm from L.A., from Los Angeles.
Okay.
Definitely. In terms of growing up in L.A., I mean, what was it like in terms of your influences and what part of L.A., in terms of life?
Growing up in L.A., I was, I'm like mostly a lot of people that grew up in L.A., you know, statistics of the crack epidemic with our parents. Systematic racism with our parents. Mom was on drugs, father was in the pen. You know, grandmother raised me, and I just had to kind of hustle and make it, you know, do what it do on my own. And as far as L.A., you know, I'm from L.A., but, you know, I try to just still travel and network and be other places as well.
Yeah, in terms of you turning into music, like, what MCs influenced you to start rapping, like, you know, inspire your craft?
Actually, my brother, Rustin and Peace, he's the one who introduced me into rapping and doing music, because my older brother, he was rapping, and he actually wrote me my first rap when I used to go see him when he was locked up and I was a little girl. And so from there, you know, I started getting influenced by, like, the Tupacs, the Biggies, the Little Kims, and, you know, I just kind of fell in love with hip-hop from there on out.
Man, and look, L.A.'s got such a rich history in terms of the hip-hop scene, of course. You know, Mixmaster Spade, Toddy T, you know, Rodney O. and Joe Cooley. I mean, had all, you know, older spots like, you know, Skateland, Palladium. So you all, from that period, were, like, really, really beginning to find your own. You know, of course, Ice-T, N.W.A. would come along later on. What was it like in terms of growing up? You know, even in the midst of what was going on in 84 when crack hit, and just watching it, even from that, seeing it soar in terms of watching this musical scene in your hometown that would eventually become not only a trendsetter, but legendary for the contributions they would come with.
Well, this is the thing. I'm from LA, but see, I was heavily, heavily influenced by East Coast. So I was like the Rakim. I was a real big East Coast fan. I can remember the first time I ever seen Kumo D on TV. that's what I'm saying. I was a little girl, but I was always surrounded by older people growing up. So if I was like 5 years old, my brother was like 9 years older than me, and I had my cousins and my uncles and stuff like that. But, you know, I think I was influenced by the East Coast, the West Coast, by both coasts, and then even some Midwest, some Southern artists as well. But, you know, just seeing how the crack epidemic played out, it was very sad. You know, you hear a lot of guys talk about, you know, serving drugs, but they never talk about the kids or the parents that's on the other end of the stick. You get what I'm saying? Like, I was a kid that was on the other end. So I was the kid that had to go walk to a crack house with my mom and watch her hit a pipe and watch her high come up and watch her high come down and all that. And when you glorifying stuff like that, you never think about the internal damage that the kids or the parents have to go through, you know? So I just think that it was heavily influenced, but it was also a tragedy for a lot of people when you wasn't glorifying it and you was really living it.
Yeah.
And see, around that time, too, you had also records condemning the crack era. Like, you had records like Self-Destruction, We All in the Same Gang. You know, we had records like that showcasing unity, and rap actually had a voice for us, like a voice for the people. And somewhere down the lane, it just got turned into something else.
Yeah, most definitely. But that happens with time and evolution. Everything changes, you know.
Yeah. And when you think about it, what you said, you know, SK, when we think about how the music was, hip-hop, you know, of course, you know, I mean, we know it most notably from the 70s, of course, Sugar Hill Gang, even going back to The Last Poets, you know, August 11th, you know, 1972, you know, 1520 Sedgwick, you know, in the Bronx is widely recognized as hip-hop's, you know, birthday. Even going back to James Brown, you know, way back in the 60s and 70s. So we see a long history of the music it was already in its nascent forms in terms of different iterations. It's not necessarily called rap just yet, so we push it ahead once it really becomes a more streamlined street sound. But what you said really resonates, because hip-hop is a street culture. Shout out to our black and brown brothers, you know, and sisters, who really, really, you know, help cultivate it. What you said about it in terms of how everybody likes to talk about the street tales, living an authentic life in terms of talking about what you went through is one thing, but you, like you said, the drug game is a serious one. And, you know, as well as myself, you know, I've had relatives, you know, I've watched, you know, go down that tragic road of drug abuse as well. So it's nothing to really, really, really celebrate from a sense of once you understand how real that damage is. Because once you see it, it's tangible. It's something you feel. It is something you really begin to understand because you're seeing it up close. When you look at the game today, when you look at it back then, rather, do you think a lot of times a lot of rappers began to see that as the selling point rather than actually articulating a real experience? They looked at it as a way to sell records from just that, or do you, I mean, just give me your impression of it in terms of where do you think the craft really when it started moving in that direction?
You know, yeah, you know, I think that people, you know, they rap about what sells, or, you know, now it's just kind of like the drill music and, you know, how many bodies you got and people spinning the block and stuff like that. And I do think that a lot of people imitate it and don't live it, but I think a lot of rappers do live it, and that's where it messes them up as an artist, because they're bringing that real street element into, you know, their art and their business, and it doesn't mix. For artists that don't live it and they rap about it, you know, I really can't tell another artist how to create, but I do think that it does become a problem, because what you do is you're feeding the masses, which is, you know, more so you, this image and this story that you're not living, and they're going to go out there and try to do exactly what you're saying, because music is powerful. Music is really like a not a curse, but it's power to it, it's magic to it. And if you think about it, when you listen to Pac, your emotions change. If you listen to, like, back in the days, if you listen to Pac, he was on like some ride or die type stuff. If you listen to Biggie, you was on kind of like some player type stuff, you know. And I just felt like when you tell somebody, like, oh, I'm going to spend a block on my ops or whatever the case may be, that's going to become embedded in a young person's mind. I have a son at 13, and I'm going through that with him right now. You know, so yeah. I see that firsthand.
Definitely. And also, going back to your music now, you recently performed at the SXSW Conference Festival. How was that experience like?
Oh, it was real dope. I had a really good time in South by Southwest. I want to go back. It was really dope just to see different entertainers and everyone that was all up under one roof. And I didn't even realize they had different genres. I thought it was more so just hip-hop, but it was hip-hop, rock, pop, country. So I thought it was super dope.
And did they sell out a crowd out there? Because I know they were, like, eager to get out there based off things being shut down for the past year.
It was so crowded. It was crazy. I mean, it was something like I've never seen, because that was my first time going, but it was, like, super crowded.
Yeah, one thing about Southwest is definitely legendary. Yeah,
I was bringing that up because that's a important ingredient of also being a not only a star, but also a complete rapper as well, because your stage performance got to be on tack.
Yeah, very, very much so. I even performed at Coachella, and that was my first time performing and going there, and I got to see Meg Thee Stallion perform, Doja Cat, Karol G, Becky G, and it was so inspiring. because even me as an artist, it was like, okay, I really got to bring it because these girls are really, really performing.
Man. And pretty much when you, from that FK, what's the criteria? How does an artist usually get booked for those type of events? So those, I mean, Coachella, South by Southwest, I mean, those are heavy hitting venues in terms of when you're actually, you know, say to perform them.
Yeah, by either a promoter or a booking agent, something in management should set up for them.
Now, you said you saw Megan Thee Stallion and Doja Cat. And obviously, I mean, Megan, shout out to Houston. We see y'all. I mean, she has done y'all so proud. And Doja Cat has just gone nuclear. I mean, you know, I remember a few years ago when I first saw the Moo video. And I knew it was a goofy video when I saw it. I knew it wasn't meant to be taken seriously. But to watch Amala's art manifest itself and evolve in such this OMG fashion, I mean, what is it like to see these artists from when you saw them and where they've gotten to now in terms of not only, you know, being notarized but worldwide acclaim in terms of being trendsetters, pacemakers?
The one person that I've seen from the beginning was Nipsey, and just to see the legacy that he left, I'll speak on him because, you know, I helped start Nipsey's career because we're from the same area, and I can remember just when he first walked up, you know, we were talking, putting together his plan, and just to see the legacy that he has built and his team has built and he's left, it just shows that anything is possible.
Yeah, I mean, we got to shout out everybody. You said Nipsey, of course. You know, shout out Twan Gotti, Gotti Gourmet. Shout out all the Crenshaw, Slauson. Got to shout out Mike and Keys, too, you know, who worked with him extensively on a lot of his music. You know, got to shout out Pac-Man the Gunman, G.I. Joe, Jay Stone, Black Sam.
But when Nipsey first started, none of them was around. When Nipsey first started, it was John Shapiro, Steve Lovell, and Big Hugh. That's the part I'm talking about. I'm talking about when Lips Ain't Got No Name, Flossin' Boys from the beginning.
In the early days.
When they wouldn't even play his stuff because they said that he was too hardcore. And I went and argued with the owners of K-Day, with Roy Laughlin, who's the owner, and made them put his stuff on the radio. So I'm saying, like, the beginning, you know, it's easy to support somebody when they blow up. But, you know, you got to try it out when they're just starting. Everybody's telling them no.
Man,
now I'm gonna ask you this too, because recently Nipsey just got his Walk of Fame star. Now, do you feel that it's sort of bittersweet to see him getting these accolades now versus how he should have got them back then, just for the grind and just for the trends that he started to set?
I just feel like with that right there, people will celebrate you more when you're gone opposed to when you're alive. And that has a lot to do with his team as well and his family. And, you know, they're carrying his legacy and they're making all of the right moves. And I think people need to look at that, because if a lot of artists have passed away and they don't, you know, nothing has happened with their estate, with their music, nothing. And I think that Lauren London, his brother, Black Sam, and, you know, his team has a lot to do with, you know, the accolades and the acknowledgement that he's getting since he's been gone.
Yeah. And when we watched Nip, from his, what he did, I remember the XXL, I believe it was 2003 when I first seen him. You know, this is going back to the time he was with Sony Records at the time, you know, when he got his first major deal, you know, and they were talking about, you know, this kid from the Crenshaw district who was, like, really dope with it. And then we really saw, you know, Nip's hustle. You know, we saw Myers really began to evolve. You know, he really began, you know, to really, really, really market himself. When you said, SK, about what it was like in terms of him trying to get his music out, his story, which is why we celebrate it so much, because he was a local artist that won. You know, he's the voice, he's the hustle, he's the heart, he's the drive, he's the determination. He embodies the essence of everything that every aspiring artist from every hood all over wants to be. And to see him do what he did really from the ground up and to become the legend that he became, watching his movements, what did you learn from him in terms of marketability, in terms of not relying on people, you know, getting it out yourself, meeting the people, and most of all, committing yourself to the craft of making dope music?
I'm sorry, you said what did I learn from him?
Yeah, in terms of watching his rise.
I mean, I learned from myself. Like, you have to understand, I really knew Nipsey. So I knew Nipsey when Nipsey was Thundercat. So my point of view and the next person's point of view is going to be different.
Right.
You know, if I keep it 100, I feel like Nipsey was just with Jay-Z. He made too many powerful moves. So he shouldn't even been over there in that situation because he was already above it. You know,
right.
And I think that that's something that people don't want to talk about because they dance around that, and you can't dance around that because that has to be a teachable moment for the next person that will reach the success or the next young black boy that's smart like Nipsey and have the intelligence. Sometimes you can be so loyal to the soil, but in the end, it can mess you over, and that's what happens. You know, and I think that people skip over that and people want you to say, well, this or what did you learn? Like, no. Like, at the end of the day, that is something that shouldn't have happened. But you also have to look at it. The whole situation is he shouldn't have been in that situation. He was already too much on a different platform to even confront somebody about his business. Someone else should have did that, not him. Because he was already making other moves that people were looking up to him about.
SK,
I feel like that's a conversation that people need to speak on, you know, because it's a life that shouldn't have been lost. And it's like, well, what can we learn from this so it won't happen again? You know, it was a lot of people that was jealous of Nipsey. I used to tell him that. It was a lot of people that was jealous of him. His spirit
right.
was for his team to win. So he had a spirit where he wanted his team to win. He wanted his team to eat. But he also switched teams within the neighborhood, and you got to look at that as well. It's a lot of stuff that you have to unpack. You know, and I really don't say too much. I just let things be how they be. But I have my opinion, but I'm not going to suppress my opinion to please the masses. At the end of the
right.
day, that situation shouldn't have happened, and Shitty shouldn't have even been confronted.
And, I mean, SK, I agree. We agree 1,000% with you because when we look at how the business works, we know about the street. Nipsey was as real as they came from the street. We all know that. His tragedy is the tragedy of a lot of individuals because there is always this emphasis on the staying authentic. Like you said, loyal to the soil. You know, everybody wants to say that they can still go back to their hood. And a lot of people don't understand it. Like you said, once you get money, once you get notoriety, once you get prestige, once you get fame, the wolves are going to come out.
You got to change how you move.
Green out monster. Everything that is going to entail hate is going to arise because me and him had a conversation a couple months ago off air about this. When people see you succeed, you would like to think everybody would be happy for you, but the reality is it brings a lot of embitterment and enmity because they see you succeeded where maybe they endeavored and failed, where you had failed. And when we see this a lot of times too, you know, King and SK, we see a lot of artists that unfortunately, usually when they get killed, where do usually 95% of artists usually get killed? In their own hometown, in their hood. I don't know if we got enough show to run down how many artists have lost their lives from where they came from.
I mean, you know, it's just like, look, at the end of the day, you know, we in the black community, it is a crab in a barrel mentality. It's so many things to unpack with our people, if you know, if we don't even have enough time to do it. People want to dance around things. People want to cover up what the truth is and what the facts are. At the end of the day, this is for anybody. If you reach a certain level of success, it is okay to go back to your hood. It is okay to help your neighborhood. It is okay to uplift people in the neighborhood. But when you're trying to check somebody about paperwork or you're trying to check somebody about hood politics, for what, when you're already reaching a certain level, that shouldn't even matter. It should be what can you put into the community to help the younger boys that's looking up to you. And people, no one's talking about that. Nobody is talking about that. And me, I have two sons. My biggest fear is not the police killing my son. My biggest fear is somebody looking like him killing him. The tragedy that's been upon me, the hurt, the pain, everything has always been by somebody within our community. It ain't really been by other ethnicities and other races. And even within this music industry, being from L.A., you deal with the politics. I'm from the street, but I know how to move. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And I move different. So you have to ask yourself, why is it like that? Why is it like that with our people, with everything that we touch or we're attached to? You don't hear about people getting killed in country music. You don't hear about people getting killed in pop. You don't hear about people getting killed in EDM. Why is everything violent with what we do? Nobody talks about stuff like that. No one even want to touch on that topic. But then if the police kill one of us, we screaming and hollering, but it's okay for us to keep harming each other and mothers to keep crying and keep burying their kids and rappers to get killed every other day. It's the norm.
And that's something that I think is, like you said.
I think there's two. Yeah. I think there's two answers to that. Like, number one, a lot of within hip hop, they bring a lot of the street element. The street element, with that comes death.
Absolutely.
In more ways than one. So you bringing that element into the music, and that's where 9 times out of 10 those confrontations end up being fatal. Whereas, you know, every genre has their issues. But go ahead.
No, take off the street element. So take that out. It don't even have to be street stuff. It can just be this nigga hating on this nigga, or this nigga want to fuck my bitch, or they like just dumb stuff. So you done shot this boy, killed this boy over what? Every race have their issues, right? Well, that's cool. But with us, every race ain't killing each other every single day. That's out. It ain't happening. We can pull up the statistics. This is what I do. Every race is not killing each other every single day. Every single day. My grandmother buried three sons. Three. I watched my grandmother bury three of her sons. One of my uncles' funeral was on my birthday. I lived it. So when a person say that, you probably won't even find nobody that have my type of life story. I watched my grandmother bury her son. And the person who killed my uncle, he lived with us for 2 years. We didn't even know he killed him. He helped us bury him with a pallbearer at the funeral, spoke at the funeral, everything. 2 years, we didn't know. 2 years later, he got killed with his family. And my uncle was in jail on a life sentence because of that. And my daddy is the one who turned state evidence on all of us. So a person can't tell me nothing about the street, nothing about tragedy, nothing about pain, and nothing about it being mixed up with hip-hop. I lived it. And because of those situations, I'm an introvert. Because of those situations, I watch how I move. And because of those situations, I don't work and mix with everybody. So when I see these young black men keep getting killed, it's a cycle that no one talks about. And
it
what
is.
You try to do is say, well, hold up and say, well, every race, nah, that's out. Every race don't go through this, not on a daily. Pull up the statistics and show me how many black men are getting killed, how many black women are getting killed every single day, every city, every state. Tell me. It is sickening, and it spills over to the music, and it takes the creative, artistic work out of it. It's sad.
You are, you know, SK, we agree, because we've seen something happen, because we've seen it change, because at one point when we saw the music was actually, and we'll probably catch flack saying it on air, but we do what we do, and hey, we're gonna speak our truth on how we understand it. When we look at the 80s to the 90s, when we saw gangster rap at its peak, we were seeing it was about stories that were being told. Now, you had artists that had their problems, and that's always been, because wherever there's a street element, there's always going to be some issues there. But it was never a situation where back then that it was actually, and I know I'm going to tread into some dangerous water when I say this, it was never a situation back in the day where you were basically endorsing the murder of another black man on a record to a degree. There were diss tracks, and there were plenty. But to say that you were just going to go out and blast somebody and their whole family, that was almost unheard of back then. You know, but when we look at what was going on outside the music in the streets, you're looking at a situation from lack of education. You're looking at poverty. You're looking at just a cycle of dysfunction within the family itself that is perpetuated and ultimately manifests itself in violence.
Wait a minute. And let me stop you, because I'm so happy you said that, right? Because I was talking about this in an interview that I just did. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about the dysfunction of the black family is very dysfunctional. And for a person mm-hmm. like me, I had to relearn how to live normal, because I came from such a dysfunctional family, such a toxic family, such a violent
right.
family, and that's all I knew, because that's all I seen. And it wasn't until I broke away from them and I learned, like, I talked to nobody in my family because they're too dysfunctional, and I had to teach myself, mm-hmm. okay, you don't have to act like that because of this, or you don't have to get mad and want to fight people, or you don't have to want to bring harm on people because of this. And that's something else that people do not talk about. It's like we celebrate violence. We celebrate,
you know. You're right.
We celebrate harming one another.
And the problem is, we've seen with this, is that SK, this is a great discussion we're having. I'm so glad we got so much time to keep discussing on this, among other things. One thing about it is that we look at, as black people, we, and my brother and me have talked about this off air. We have talked about this with our friends. For some reason, with some of us, not all of us, but with some black people, there is this authentication of your blackness by adversity, by drama, by conflict, by negativity. It's almost like for you to be black and to grow up in an environment that is sensible, that is grounded, that is, you know, moral, people will say you ain't real because you ain't been through, you know, no shootout. Your people ain't sold, you know, ain't slang on the block. You ain't busted a gun, you know. And we've developed a very, as a people, some of us have developed a very, very dangerous fascination and romanticism with war culture, from relationships in terms of abuse to street drama. And what you said about
trauma,
and it's not only just exactly, and it's not only from the streets. It also goes into relationships. We're about to go there. It's like we're regular dudes who, you know, who are, you know, work a regular 9-to-5, you know, try to stay out of trouble.
Oh, shit.
Some women, not all, But some black women say, well, they're lame because they not thugs. And they so we ask at times, what is the fascination with the thug culture for some women? And some women equate the thug to being the alpha male. You know, they say it can protect them. But then the game is flipped. What do you do when that alpha male becomes the aggressor towards you and you have nobody to protect you from him?
Right.
You know, we're seeing situations where we're looking at the wrong elements of what validates black masculinity and what validates black femininity. And we have to, like you said, we have to reteach, rewire ourselves to understand that, you know, there's certain elements growing up. You can't get away from what you grew up in because that's going to be a part of you. But it doesn't have to be who you are for the rest of your life. Razzcast said in the Stolen Ice remix, the diameter of your knowledge is the circumference of your activity. And if you don't endeavor to educate yourself more, you're going to be stuck in that circle of chaos. When was your epiphany, FK, of understanding, you know, certain behaviors were not normal? In terms of what was that point when you realized, like, yo, this is what I was seeing, what I was growing up in. It was not what I wanted to live my life.
I think it's just getting older, you know, like me growing up, I have, you know, uncles and stuff, and my brothers, all the men in my family has been killed. They're all dead. My brother was damn near the last of the Mohicans. And it's just when you look back to each of the tragedy of their lives and what happened to them, it's like, okay, it's not normal. Like, it's not normal to go and rob and kill your friend. It's not normal to plan murders. Like, I was really involved in some with my family, like, some real shit. Like, and I'm talking about stuff that's already public record, so it's on the news. Like, you know, my uncle was dealing with this attorney, Angela Wallace, and I think this was the turning point for me. And so Angela was a high-end attorney. She was my attorney. You know, black lady, fly, had her money, right, everything. Long story short, she put a hit out on her clients and got them killed, right?
Whoa.
They were kids.
Oh, man.
But hold up, they were kids, right? So she put the hit out on them and she get them killed, and they were kids. Now, my whole family, we're all involved. My brother's on the run for it. These boys were 17 and 18, and the police officer, she died of a brain aneurysm. She was a sergeant. You guys can look the story up. She was a sergeant. And they had got $380,000 from their mother life insurance policy. Long story short, Angela got greedy and sold the whole policy from her. They found out when they confronted her. A week later, she got them killed. Now, these are people that I'm dealing with every single day. This is family. And I have, and my father is the one who wore the wiretap, and the whole time I didn't know my father had a wire and turned state evidence on me and my whole family. None of that is normal. And when you look at the case, it was like, well, this person was supposed to commit the murder, and this person, I'm surrounded by a family of convicts, killers, hustlers, and it's dysfunction. I have no chance. So as a kid, and I always told them this, y'all exposed me to too much as a child. Nobody protected me but my grandmother, and she died. So as a kid growing up in LA, I had no innocence. I had no protection because I was born into a dysfunctional family. And I really had to step back and do some soul searching because it's like, you know, but my sanity was music. And people don't understand that. If I didn't have music, I'd probably be in jail for life. So my therapy, my getaway was the creation of the music. And I had to cut everybody off because they have no conscience. And when you have no conscience, you can do anything to anybody and don't even think about it. And that's the type of family I come from.
You know, people, you know, SK, people get involved in the street life and they think, when we look at so many different individuals, we look at guys like, you know, Ray Fulton, we look at guys like Boy George Rivera, Pretty Tone, you know, from New York as well. So many of these street legends, you know, Felix Mitchell. It's wild because, you know, when you begin to understand and unpack what they, you know, obviously we're not snitching on the show. We're not telling nothing that nobody doesn't know because it's all, like you said, public record. But when you look at the situations of what the real street life is, people think about it from the level of, and I think that's why in the music a lot of times it gets glamorized, because there is a certain type of academia look, savvy and savagery, not in that order, that you have to survive it. And everybody sees it from a perspective of everybody's got the rollies, the fly whips, and, you know, the fresh linen, but they don't know about the paranoia. They don't know about the backstabbing. They don't know about when your relatives could get hit if they can't get to you. There's a whole different side to this of the street life that people really, really, really don't understand. It's like what happened with Tekashi when he got involved with the Bloods up in New York. You know, he's looking at it as he's getting with some individuals who can give him street credibility, not understanding that these dudes he aligned himself with are real street guys. You know, and then when he found out he was in too deep, you know, when he found out he was in too deep like Omar Epps, and he's understanding, like, you know, they're like, oh, shit, like, I'm really in something. You know, like, of course, and for those that don't know about In Too Deep, that movie was based on a real story about Daryl Whitney, a.k.a. God, you know, up in Boston, you know, who was a heavyweight. You know, that's In Too Deep was based on that story.
He got that Gusto character.
Yeah. You know, street life is, everybody thinks it's something to live until you actually got to live it. When you started to get into the music in terms of cultivating your craft, what was it like in terms of those early creations when you put your energy towards it? What did you want to express for yourself and for your perspective?
I mean, I was a storyteller, so the first time I stepped in the studio, you know, I was like 12, and I just wanted to tell a story. I wanted to rap. And the first studios I stepped in was a guy named Chewy from 17 Days and Mark Gordon from the Bruce LeVert. So Mark, those are the studios that I stepped in that introduced me to the, you know, to hip-hop and the rap game and stuff.
And what did you learn in terms of, like, you know, what was it like going into the studio and really getting around the equipment and just really, you know, like, what was it like just having that, like, that it moment, like, I'm really here?
I mean, it was, you know, I was young, so I was excited. I think like any young person, you know, you're excited and you just want to make some magic. You want to make it happen. You know, and back when I was doing it, it wasn't a lot of kids my age. Actually, it really wasn't no kids my age. You know, and I was just in there and just making it happen.
And as you began to tell those stories. Go ahead, Ken, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say that as you're getting in, you're learning the game, and you end up on the Roll Records on 2002, and you're one of the ladies up there next to Crooked Eye, Eastwood, Corrupt. I remember seeing you on I see you on one of the magazines up there. And did you have
I was
like
around
album
before.
But you're,
I was around before then, though. That's just when I signed.
Mm-hmm.
But what did you say?
Yeah, I was asking, like, how much material did you record up there? Do you guys have any unreleased albums up there?
Yeah, I have unreleased songs and everything, but, you know, I don't know what they're going to do with it. I don't really talk to no one from over there like that. I just kind of do my own thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I did record a lot of stuff.
And what was it like being around all of them? Like you said, you were around all of them before you actually got signed, but what was it like being around them in terms of watching them develop as well as yourself?
I mean, I always tell people I learned a lot from Suge. You know, Suge used to always tell me, don't let nobody take advantage of me. Don't let nobody tell me what to do. He was like, you record how you want to record. You do what you need to do for yourself. You know, I learned a lot from him. And just seeing, you know, the outcome of everything, you know, I was able to get on Pac's album. I was able to do Dogtown album. I was able to record some of the material. You know, it was a really good, it's a real good memory for me.
Yeah.
And
shout out to
and you getting on the Tupac joint, I was saying you getting on the Tupac joint, that gave you your first plaque, correct?
That gave me my first plaque. And, you know,
yeah.
Like, them niggas, but this is the thing. Like, them niggas really was hating on me over there, you know? And Suge was the one who was having my back mostly. And I say that to say, when you're in a situation, you got to go for what you know. Because out of everybody over there, I'm damn near the only one that got my plaques and got certain things. They got stories. But they don't, you know, I was the one that made sure I was getting paid, getting all my shit. And that's being business, having making sure your business is together, like even now. And I've seen a few interviews where I'm not going to even say who it is, but, you know, like the niggas try to discredit me or try to act like I wasn't a factor, and it's like, but my guy, like my nigga, I'm still shaking and moving, and I got so many things up. Like, I wrote all my stuff, and I got the plaques and everything. You ain't got nothing but YouTube story. So it's very important. No, but I'm keeping it a bug.
Right.
You know, and I just right. gotta, because you got a lot of niggas that be on groupie status, and that hang around and try to hate on the next artist or hate on the next female, or, you know, and why they doing that, okay, say less. I'm going to do what I do over here, and we going to see what I got at the end and what you got at the end.
Yeah. Shout out to Kenya Ware. We interviewed her last year, friend of the show. She always speaks highly of Suge, you know, when we talk to her. What do you want people to understand about those Death Row days? Because there's so much to be said about it from him and what was going on. But obviously, you know, from your experience, you know, and with Suge, you know, he always looked out for you.
I mean, at the end of the day, Suge kept his word with me. He did some shit I didn't like that I'm getting corrected
right.
now, you know. But that it comes with the territory, so it is what it is. He still let me be a part of history and a legacy, and I'm forever grateful for that. But, you know, like, I try to look towards what I got popping now. You know what I'm saying? Like, a lot of people hold on to the past, and they be stuck in the past. I'm grateful for the opportunity. I'm grateful to be a part of the history and a part of the legacy. And that's just kind of like where I want to leave it, because I got so many things popping now and I'm just excited for my future.
Absolutely. And pretty much as you look at it right now in terms of what's going on present day, where do you feel the music scene is at right now? And what inspires you to this day to keep going in the industry doing what you do?
I think right now the music is just still evolving. Like I said, everything changes. Everything. History changes. Time changes. Everything changes. And you just got to rebrand and evolve with the time. As far as me, I signed to a label, Blackout Records, to drop an EDM project. So I'm going heavy into the EDM world because they pay good. Yeah. So I have an EDM record dropping with Paul Wall and another artist, Gucci Savage, and that dropped September the 1st. And so they're preparing me to start performing at festivals the first quarter of next year. So I'm just really focused on that.
Yeah, I've also seen that you did some work with, I was going to say too, that I also seen that you did some work with Sugar Free. And that's actually one of my favorite MCs now.
Yeah.
How did that collab come to fruition?
So I hit him because I wanted to get him on my album Unfinished Business. And so I had hit him up, and we did the joint, we did the song, did the video, and they liked it so much they put it on his album. So that's a song I got called Break 'Em, featuring Sugar Free.
I mean, look, Pomona's, you know, Sugar Free, one of the kings of Pomona, you know, shout to him, Cocaine, you know, Big Hutch from Above the Law, well, the whole Above the Law collective. You know what I mean? It, knowing that you
Oh, yeah,
still,
shout out to Hutch.
Yeah, man, Uncle Hutch, man, we love Hutch, man, friend of the show as well.
Yeah.
When you think about it today and that you're still able to reach, I mean, not only work, but work with legends. How does that feel to intertwine your legacy with theirs, knowing that you all combined for something, you know, monumental?
You said with who?
I said, how does it feel with your legacy being intertwined with theirs, how you both bring your legendary lineages together to create something monumental, where you both
Who is theirs? Who are you speaking about?
Like Paul Wall, like you said, Sugar Free, all these artists that you work with.
I mean, like, this was my thing. I wanted to make sure I had good features for my album. So I got a song with Anthony
right.
Hamilton. I'm about to go to Jamaica to shoot a video with Benny Mon. So this was my reintroduction because at the end of the day, it's cool I was on death row, okay. But, you know, like, everybody is, what are you doing now? And so I'm rebuilding my brand now with the new stuff that I have going on. And I'm excited because, you know, I'm just trying different things. And, you know, I featured on Pac, I featured on the Dogtown, but I got my own album, Unfinished Business, and I got the Anthony Hamilton, the Benny Mons, the Paul Walls, the Sugar Freeze. I have them all on my project, you know. And I'm about to drop another album, another part of Unfinished Business, which is another album in December. So, you know, I'm just working and I'm just excited because I got a lot of things going on. And, yeah, I'm excited.
Have you ever a book in the works?
I had a book I dropped, but no. Right now, I got a few films that that I'm working on. So we're about to drop a few films next year. So I'm just working on that. No books right now.
Got you. I mean, for like you said, okay, in terms of, you know, rebranding and rebuilding yourself, you've made a hell of an entry coming back in. I mean, how? I mean, some artists. You know, usually when they take time off or they're trying to come back in, it's not as easy. And you slid through just as smooth as the four tops, you know, on a silk carpet, you know, all choreographed, you know, with the move. What is that like where you're, you know, you coming back in was not as arduous as some artists?
I mean, I look at it like, you know, everything is the grind and hustle, but I'm still working. Like, I haven't even reached the level to where I know that I'm capable of reaching because it's still a grind. Everything is still a work in progress, you know. But, I mean, for every day that I'm able to wake up and God give me another day to create and make something happen, I'm grateful. Like, I'm really grateful.
Definitely. And, you know, to build off what you were saying about being stagnant. Being stagnant is the worst thing an artist can do, especially when they came out from the period from the 90s and early 2000s where you debuted. I've seen a lot of artists that, you know, became very stagnant and they didn't evolve with the time. So if you gaining that behind-the-scenes knowledge and learning how to be a content creator, that help you in your involvement.
Most definitely. And just, you know, researching and teaching myself how to do things. Like, I remember I wanted to get in the film game, and I kept asking people, hey, what's up? Could you help me do this? Help me do that? No one helped me but one person. And from him helping me, you know, now I got probably 30 projects on 2D. I'm doing my first feature where the budget is $3 million. I just submitted another film for a $2 million budget. Now is I don't even need y'all. And I asked you for help. But see, that's why you can't ask friend course people. And it's not that no one was obligated to help me. But if you see I'm hungry and you see I'm grinding and I'm willing to learn and I'm willing to work and you shit on me, it's cool. But you never know where God going to place me. You feel me? So you can't
stagnate.
Like you can't. You cannot stagnate. And you can't have a person feel like, never let a person feel like, oh, you got to fuck with them in order for you to pop off. That's out. That's out. Because I'm going to get to it no matter, like, who with me, I'm going to get to it.
What we learned from you over since we had you on the show is that you didn't let anything stop. Like, a lot of people would escape through in the towel because this business is like it's a sharp red business. So for you to preserve like you've been doing and you being a female at that, because this game is rough on females, it's commendable.
It's very rough on females. And another thing that a person needs to do that I would tell people is diversify your connections. You got to diversify out. You think Diddy and Beyonce and Jay-Z, you think they don't have diversified connections? Like, you got to mix and mingle with other ethnicities. You got to, you have to diversify out because other people will open up doors for you that your own folks won't.
Yeah. And in terms of being able to make those moves, that is the most important thing. We're gonna say it on air because once again, this is some shit that everybody knows about. When we look at the situation, what happened with Jay and Dane, everybody was looking at Jay a certain way, but I'm like, Jay was making moves for himself because Jay was understanding. Jay-Z has always been that individual who always understood business from an aspect of what was coming next, and he made moves in accordance of understanding what he had to do to further. It wasn't about fuck all these other niggas. It's about what worked. You know, it was about what he knew he had to do for him. When you listen to his verse on DJ Khaled's new album, you know, God did. And you listen to his Jay's go off on that verse. It's like basically him telling his story of how he had to make the moves to do what he had to do. And people cannot stay in one area and expect to advance because all you're doing is standing still. You're not moving forward. And there's also understanding that the old ways don't pay for new days, you know, but new ways will forever pave the way to get paid every day. You know what I'm saying? And a lot of people got to understand that. You always got to know what's coming next.
Wait, let me tell you this. I met Jay-Z and Dane. Meek, Memphis Bleek, Benny Siegel. All them niggas was rude as shit, okay? All of them. You know who the most humble person was? Do you know who took time out their day to talk to me? Do you know who sat and listened to me spit a verse and told me to call him, gave me his number? Do you know who was the only person that made me feel like a human being and who really took time out to talk to me out of all them niggas? Jay-Z. So when people say, so when people want to talk about him, you got to look at the facts. Them niggas was cocky, loud, all that. And I met all of them. The only person that was respectful to me was Jay-Z.
And Jay, you know, and you think about with Nipsey. When Nipsey came out with the Crenshaw mixtape, who bought 100 copies just to show he supported that man Hustle? Jay-Z.
A person can't say nothing bad about Jay-Z to me. Yeah. A person can't say nothing bad about Jay-Z to me. Because you got to look at that. This is why this man is over here with his family, chilling with his family. Damn, you still talking about it. You still, because you hurt. But you got to look at the role you played. He wanted to elevate. he wasn't going to be stagnant because of you.
But, you know, but what you said, and Ken were there, you know, SK, because I remember, hey, Ken, you remember that video from 2000, you know, where Dane says, "The Rock, you bastards," and, you know, you just see Jay.
And Jay was sitting there, and he was looking up, He knew right then and there. He like, "Oh, yeah, it's over. I'm leaving."
He's like, "Look. Look at that caption, the moment Jay knew he was done with them niggas."
Yes.
But yeah, but I mean, Jay saw something. Jay knew that whatever the situation was, and we know a little bit about it, you know, from what was told. We're never going to know the whole story because only Jay and Dane really know everything with it. But Jay saw a situation where ultimately getting that presidency with Def Jam, you know, it was an opportunity. And it was a fact of, and really, you know, when you look at how the situation from what Jay said about what was going on with Reasonable Doubt, about how all he did was ask Dane for, he wanted that record, you know, in terms of the full masters. And Dane kind of bucked on him about it, you know, and, you know, and Jay was like, you know, well, you know, the album didn't sell a lot, you know, so it's not a lot of money, but it's like, that was my baby, you know, and that's all I wanted. And there's a point in business that, you know, there should be no business to get that acrimonious that two friends who started something together can't come to some type of an agreement. Where and it doesn't get disrespectful, you know. Because
right.
At the end of the day, you know, my thing is, what we do together, we started together, and we can work it out together. But it's the moment separation. It's the moment of separation because we can't talk about and openly communicate something that will cause that. Because the thing is, ultimately, it's a situation you never want to say fuck that nigga, but by the same token, you look at it from this perspective. It's not fuck that nigga. It's like, I got to do what's best, and I'm going to be all right regardless. It's no hate, but I got to elevate.
Right.
You know,
now, from my understanding, what's his name? Big Kareem? Is that his name?
Big, yeah. Kareem,
yeah.
Big. Yes,
Big.
Yeah.
Big and Jay-Z is still cool. So why is Big cool and Dame isn't?
Well, disclaimer. This is T-Max just giving his personal opinion. This opinion does not represent all the views of Off the Cuff Radio. Nah, but for real. Biggs has always been a very, very quiet guy. You know, there were the three. When you know the history of The Rock, it was Biggs, Dame, and Jay. Biggs has always been the silent partner, as they would say it. You never hear about Biggs. Only time you really heard about Biggs was when he did that bid for that weed growing. And, of course, he's been out a few years now. I think he did like 4 years for that, for having illegal plants before it got legal. But Biggs has always been the quiet dude. You never saw him being flashy, even though he had just as much money as they did because he was a shareholder in The Rock. You never saw him really get out there talking, doing crazy things. He was a guy who understood sometimes anonymity or even public anonymity is your best identity. Dane, we've seen Dane cut up. And depending on who you talk to with Dane, a lot of people say Dane is a, you know, he can be difficult. A lot of people say he's an asshole. Some people will say he's an asshole because he fights for his artist. And we've seen Dane, you know, fight for his artist. We've seen that. Like with the situation, you remember back in the day when they had a reality show and an old dirty bastard got out and basically he was, and they were negotiating a deal and Dane was saying, "I'm only paying dirty," because RZA was trying to get some money out of that too. And Dane was saying, "I'm only paying dirty." Yeah. This is when
it was like an old dirty special.
Yeah. So Dane was saying, "I'm only paying dirty," you know. But Dame also has shown at times that he can be overly abrasive. And when you're dealing in business, especially with certain people of influence of, and yes, power, there's nothing wrong with standing 10 toes down, being firm in what you believe. But then there's also a situation, you got to know the art of diplomacy. And, you know, me and King, we joke about it off the air a lot. You can't keep kicking people in the nuts all the time thinking that they're going to be okay with it. You can't do
that. Arrogant
you just can't.
Look at the arrogant shit he was doing, like that, oh, all that, I only wear one T-shirt once and I throw it away, all that.
Yeah, you know, it eventually becomes a situation where, you know, success is one thing, but you don't let it go to your head. And when you're understanding you're dealing with people who may not necessarily, well, I can't even say don't have as much money, because some of the people they were dealing with had way more money than they did at the time. And they were loaded.
But
you're also dealing with people who, and this is just in a general context, you always should be respectful to everybody, because that person may not necessarily have the money or the resources you have, but guess what? They know people that you don't, and they can get to people that you can't get to. You respect, like they say, and King and myself, we were taught this. Our families always showed us humble.
You respect the janitor the same way you respect the president. It ain't no different. Let me
go get you one. Exactly. You respect the janitor the same as the CEO. You know.
Yep.
And
yeah, all
you,
this.
When you look at when you look at a business now, SK, how do you feel like it's changed now in terms of artists' entry into the business from when you started?
You could blow up off a TikTok song. There's so many different ways to blow up now. You know, so the access to an artist is much easier, but the value of an artist is much less.
What do you think caused that?
Huh?
What do you think caused that? Do you think it's because of the accessibility now in terms of artists being able to get in, that the value in terms of creativity, the bar for, you know, substance has been lowered?
I mean, I just think that it's just times have just changed now, and there's so much access to where you could just find the next big thing, you know, and even how they have that virtual artist, what was his, Mecca, is that his name?
Yeah, they actually, and they terminated that situation after they, we got to take a detour with that too, because I'm so glad you brought that up. Because he was, did y'all see that video? Yeah, did y'all see that video where he talked about how he didn't know that his voice was going to be used for that?
Did he say what?
He made a video, right, about how he didn't know that his voice was going to, it's like basically, it was a shit show of everything in terms of what not to do in terms of, you know, because it's like he was saying like there was no agreement, like, King can tell you more about it than I can, you know, but go ahead, King.
Yeah, they were shady with the paperwork because the original creator was a black guy, and they went ahead and they showed them out the paperwork.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. I seen that. But
yeah.
I was going to say, I think it's going to be like that in the future. I think that's what we're about to see. That was a test for us. Oh, we're about to see that. Things are really about to change with NFTs, crypto, virtual reality. We are definitely about to see more of that.
And see, the way they do it now, they're going to find somebody popular to endorse it. I think that's where usually a lot of experiments like that receive the green light. Like, once you see somebody popular endorse it, they figure, hey, the masses are going to accept it.
Very much so. Very much so.
But, you know, it's crazy because we saw that whole thing where it was essentially a white person behind that, you know, who was, you know, with all of that. What does that say about in terms of how us being people of color in the industry have to maintain our hold on the industry to make sure that, you know, we don't get exploited?
Well, I see, go ahead.
I mean, I think we're past that. We've already been exploited, you know, and that's just keeping it real. If you look at it, anything that we do as black people that's originally ours, they make it universal. And I don't think people look at that and understand that. You know, hip-hop started from us telling our stories, you know, the things that we did through from the East Coast to the West Coast to the South. Now you have it to where if you look on social media, you have Asian rappers that rap in their language. You have rappers from Russia that rap in their language. And all of these people are making 10 times more money than African-American rappers. So it's already been exploited because their thing is music is universal. And at this point, hip-hop is universal. And it's being made to where it doesn't belong to us anymore. It belongs to everyone.
Yeah, when you go universal, all hands are all in the jar now. Like,
very
it goes beyond
so.
Being a black
thing. Look at how many, right, because you have a lot of white rappers, and guess what? I know one white rapper right now where he just caters to the white audience, and that's where he makes his money from. So he doesn't even need the black audience. He does rap, he does hip-hop, and he is... Everything is catered to the white audience. And I see the setup and I'm like, wow, this is crazy. Because this is something we created, but this is something now that's considered for everyone.
Yeah, I think you're talking about Tom McDonald.
Yep, that's who I was talking about. I didn't even say his name. So let me tell you about Tom. I didn't say Tom because I wasn't going to say his name.
He's from Canada.
So Tom, so let me tell you something. Yeah, I got Tom when Tom first started. Tom used to tell me, SK, if I don't make it by the time I'm 25, I'm going to kill myself. I'll be like, Tom, you tripping. Tom and came to my house, around my kids, everything. Now, when Tom first came out here, Tom was, he had a black girlfriend. I don't know if a lot of people know that. His girlfriend was a black girl. This is before all the tattoos and everything. So he was heavily influenced, you know, from the black culture. And as time went on, you know, because I had sent him a DM like, Tom, this shit sounds racist. And he's like, no, it's not racist. Okay, whatever. As time went on, you know, he flipped it. Now he got a white girlfriend. His audience is white. His team is white. Like, how I met Tom, the kid that I met, and how he is now is different. But he's doing what works for him. And he doesn't really need a black audience for what he's doing. And he will argue you down that he is a rapper. He's a rapper. And he feels like he deserves this just as much as anybody else. On top of, he is talented, but I see the game as being played.
Yeah.
And he actually tapped into that lane, the alt-right Republican lane, where, you know, he spoke against, you know, when you got titles like Snowflakes and stuff, he's speaking their language in a way, and in a term, it doubled his dollars.
Yeah. Yeah, and he unfollowed me. We was following each other and everything. He unfollowed me, I unfollowed him, whatever. Whatever works for you. But that's what I'm saying. I remember people when they first start, and then I get to see when they reach their peak. And how Tom was at first when he had his black girlfriend and he was into the culture, he flipped it. So he still wants to do our music, but he wants to cater towards his people.
And
that's a bittersweet thing about it. That's very bittersweet. I was going to say that's very bittersweet because We even went through that stage ourselves when we help people find their voice within their own platforms. As soon as they get a little bit ahead, they don't really need you no more. They either block you or they unfollow you. We can definitely relate.
Yeah, and you know, I still check on his stuff because I want to see what he becomes. And look how I said his name. I mean, look how I said I described him, but I never said his name. And you guys tapped in and said his name because clearly you see what I see.
Yeah. I mean, and when one thing I'm going to say, because all of us are of like mind, so we got that telekinesis thing on. We all kind of know what the deal is. We just don't necessarily want to say it on air. That's a whole different discussion. But one thing about it is when you're looking at black culture, you know, and we got to say black and Latin culture because like I said earlier, our Latin brothers and sisters are part of hip hop too. You know, they're part of it. Any hip hop culture in general is flavorful, it's spicy, it's different, it's edgy, it's anti-establishment. It's what we want to express and not what society tells us we have to be. And that's what makes it alluring. When you deal with also America's history of being the rebel, when you look at our history of how we became an independent country. So that element of it is always going to be engaging for those that kind of want to, how you say, they want to kind of have a fascination with it, but then it turns into people want to have a fascination and then interpret it on their terms, which is something totally different from how it started from what it stood for.
And this is the thing. I look at Tom Singh. A person can't tell me he don't say the word nigger. A person can't tell me he doesn't be amongst his own and have these conversations. You cannot. I will put my last dollar on it because I see it's written all over. And even when I'm confronting him, he's like, you know, I'm not racist, but no, you are now. And if that's what you choose to be, so be it. But that's what you are now.
And when you, and one thing about it is we don't necessarily have to get out there. We all know the type of, like King said, the type of crowd that is identified with them. You know, we know that. So one thing about it is that if you are willing to have that in terms of doing music to where you are going to have a certain crowd identify with you, then obviously they identify with you because of things that you say. Now, does that mean that you're like that? It can go either way. But obviously you got a lot of people that agree with what you say, so apparently you echo their sentiments at some level. And that's what I tell any
artist. The videos he did, White Boys, and you know, like,
right.
Like,
I feel you.
This was a kid,
right.
This was a kid that wanted this really bad, and you have to understand, there are talks that are had, like, you know, you're white and this and that, like, people have those type of talks. I'm crossing over to EDM, and, you know, the team I'm dealing with is a diverse team, but I will work with anybody. I'm not stuck to one race. I'm going to work with whoever is nice to me and whoever I want to work with. What Tom is, and this is just my opinion, and because this is somebody I know, I feel like not only does he cater to the racist crowd, but in my opinion, I feel like that has probably overtaken him. Now, when I met him, he wasn't like that. But, people change throughout the years.
What is that, in a bigger picture, SK, what does that have to say about a lot of artists in terms of where the vision starts and where ultimately they end up seeing themselves? Because his story, even if he's white, is not uncommon with a lot of other black artists, or anybody for that matter. Because at the end of the day, for a lot of artists, their whole element is they want to be heard. And I'm going to even go there with Lil Nas X. Because we've heard, and I'm not saying it's true or I'm not saying it's not true. I've heard stories, a lot of people saying that he's just taking advantage of the gay wave because there really wasn't a gay artist to really break out. Some people have gone as far as to say he's really not gay. It's just an act. But obviously, he has an audience.
Right.
We've spoken on it with the show, and we said it's on Off the Cuff. We love humanity. We don't care if you're gay, straight, whomever. You know, if you're cool,
right,
we respect you and your lifestyle. You know, that's just us having love for everybody in the world. But have we thought that Lil Nas X has gotten obnoxious? Absolutely, because our thing is, dude, your sexuality is your business. We don't care if you're gay or not, but the thing is, let your music speak for itself in terms of, instead of doing a whole bunch of stunts to basically show everybody, well, you're this. Well, we see it, you know, so what's next?
Right.
You know,
are you talking about the jail video he did?
Well, not so much the videos, it's just how he, it's like how he seems at times, he wants to be out there, like almost over the top. And we've seen, and I've said this before, and I will say this again, I said this before on earlier shows, you're not special because you're black and gay, you're not special because you're a black gay rapper, and you're not the first person to be a black gay and be rapping. You know, you're not the first. You know,
right?
You know, so you're not, you know, don't carry it like, you know, you're some anomaly in a sense. Because at the end of the day, you know, we know plenty of gay artists that were unbelievably talented. You know, we look at Elton John. You know, we look at George Michael, rest in peace. You know, we know Liberace, the great pianist. He was, I mean, Steve Lacy, who I'm a big fan of, you know, who came out as bisexual a couple of years ago. And Steve Lacy is just, he that dude has got that. He's just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
But his music and their music speaks for itself in terms of quality, accessibility, and it's not gimmicky. It's about talent. It's about letting the music find the audience it's supposed to find and let them, you know, be immersed in it, in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's all it is. You know, but when we see the game today, we look at a lot of these artists that come in, and it's wild, man, because you see so many people, they put so much into the music. King, myself, yourself, we all understand this is being independent. We've all traveled that independent route at one time or another. So we understand what it's like where you really, really have to go by your hustle and your heart, making network connections by the most organic of fashion in order to get on. We understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing we all have in common, we're not selling our soul to get there.
Right.
But you got a lot of artists out there, they will sell themselves to get to where they want to get to. And in
very
the end, and at the end of the day, you know, what's it worth for you if you don't have the identity that you came in with? And you let somebody else give
I know.
You your name instead of you keeping your own.
Yolani, get her, baby. I know person that sold they sold to the devil. They died. They was doing, and we didn't find out until after they died. Here, give it to her. You know what I mean? Get out
here. You said what now?
That we didn't find out until after he died that he was doing rituals to make it big in the industry.
Obviously, we're not going to say his artist name on air, but...
And he was kidnapping people. And it was crazy because a spirit came and killed him. Like, no bullshit. Like, I was scared because I'm like, okay, this is some next level type stuff that I'm not ready for. They came as soon as he finished doing a video and snatched his soul from him, and he died in his car.
And you know one thing about it, SK? I tell people, you know.
Wait, let me tell you real quick.
Go ahead, please, believe in stuff like that. Right.
And I was a person who didn't even believe in stuff like that until that happened with him. That's what made me believe in stuff like that.
I will tell you this, SK, King. Myself, I'm not overly religious more than I am spiritual, but I do believe in certain elements. I do believe in the dark world in terms of there are spirits out there that you stay away from. And I tell people, when you start messing around with black magic and these rituals and everything, and this isn't about that old Illuminati shit. I'm not talking about none of that bullshit. I'm just talking about in general when you start playing with your life from, you know, the sense of, you know, playing that Mephisto wall. For those that really understand what I said, you get it. You know, but you got people that they want to, you know, play with that in terms of they want to get in a situation. But I'm like, no. I'm like, because when you get out there in the dark world and you start conjuring up these spirits, you're dealing with forces that are beyond your comprehension. You're dealing with powers you don't understand. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They coming. They are really coming. Because I didn't believe in stuff like that at first. That's what made me believe in it. I'm like, this is deep. Like, people really be trying to sell their soul to be, like, in this industry.
But for some people, that's how they look at it, you know, because, and it's changed now because when we look at the metrics of it, we look at social media, we're all older. So we're looking at it from a different lens because that's not the era we grew up
old.
In.
I'm not old. You old, man.
Got you. Okay. Well, we're more mature. We're all collectively mature mentally.
I'm a late 80s baby.
Okay, so see, you came up in the same era we did. So your understanding of it as well as us.
No. Wait. How old are you?
I'm 44.
Oh, no. You got some years on me.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
OG.
It's like,
I'm 21, man.
But yeah, but see, we all came up with a time
you got at least a good 7 on me. But go ahead.
See, yeah, but see that all intertwines because we all came up in a time of understanding the game differently of what it entailed in the music. So we know what it means in terms of having an authentic entry into the game. You know, a lot of the younger generation today, their whole thing is they're validating their existence. The worst thing that has happened in social media in certain capacities is that it's made the younger generation think that if they don't have 10,000 followers, that if they ain't got a ton of money, if they not living a lit life online, that their life's a failure. And I'm like, no, there's more to life than being online. I'm like, and that's the problem. Nobody looks at it like, look, you see everybody online, everybody rich, everybody's got, you know, everybody living their best life, everybody's super popular. And I'm like, no, that's not the way to live. You know, it's like.
Rarely do we put our struggles online.
Exactly. Everybody's winning, but nobody shows the lost streak.
Right.
You know, and that's how everybody tries to sell it. And you have a lot of young people now, they're trying to get the trophy, the victory, and run the victory lap without doing the preparation and the practice.
Right.
And you can't get to the finish unless you done the physical training for it, and that's
right.
And that's what's happened now. And even worse now, we're seeing a lot of young people playing with things. If we're getting into certain things of rituals, that's a different deal. But what I do
they playing with
the Ouija
boards, man.
Yeah, but they're playing in terms of trying to do things in the street, having it videotaped. You know, like this is how I'm gonna get known. You know, and we see some of the silly shit, like the dude that did that rapping in front of Rick Ross's house in Atlanta. That rapper, you know, who shot a video in front of Rose's house. I'm like, I don't know why he would do something like that. You know, it was almost comical. You know, the dude's actually, you know, videotaping themselves, like getting, you know, gunfights in the street or whatever. And it's like, it's, you know, like certain things. Yeah, it's like the we see individuals who are going to do the most reckless and ratchet of things for clout. And clout is not worth your reputation, and it's most importantly not worth your life. And I just want our young people out there to understand that. You know, your life is so much more valuable. It is so much more worthwhile. It's so much more than social
more
media
than
validation.
Clout.
Exactly.
Right.
Because, you know, even in a lot of cases, like, this is a sad example. Like, what happened with Pop Smoke, West in Peace?
Oh,
nobody
that's
even,
that was so sad.
Like, even with him, he had all these followers, he had all these accolades, but yet when these people vandalized his grave site, nobody helped him. It was his parents cleaning up the grave site. So that told me right there that people are only here just for what you could give to them, what you could provide for them. But when it comes down to it,
my kids already know when I die, because I talk about death a lot with my kids because it's a part of life, and they gotta understand I'm not gonna always be here. But I already told them, I don't want no funeral. I don't want no fake-ass motherfuckers coming to my funeral that I didn't like nobody. Listen, I don't want none of that. I want a Muslim burial, and that's it. And that's the conversation that I have with my kids, because 90% of this stuff is fake. People don't really care like that. Like, everything is for a look. Most of this is an illusion. And I feel like that's where people get caught up. They get caught up in the illusion. They get caught up in the social media. They get caught up in the likes. All that is bullshit. I'm all over social media. If you can find me anywhere on social media, all my stuff. I have a very heavy social media presence. I have a lot of write-ups, all that. None of that shit means nothing when I'm dead and gone. That's something for now. That's just a look. And people get caught up in the look, they get caught up in the hype.
Like, how you going? Like, you ain't going to take your likes to the grave.
Right. Like, no. That's why I'm always spending time with my kids. I be with my family. When I'm not doing music, I'm with my family. And if I'm out and I'm popping it, I'm out on some industry stuff. I'm not an industry function. My lifestyle is of the industry. So my out time consists of stuff that consists of work or networking or branding. If I'm not, then I'm with my family.
Yeah. And that's called keeping yourself grounded and understanding, you know, your assignment, you know, in terms of your responsibility. We see a lot of people.
Listen. I just have to tell someone very much so. I just had my music video and photo shoot. On my stuff, I was just rocking some Balenciaga shades and a shirt. I got another photo shoot where I'm in all Burberry. I got another photo shoot coming up when I'm in Fendi. I don't wear that shit every day. I'm in some sweats and a sweatshirt. I love shopping at Walmart. I'm really grounded. Now, I will get dressed up and I'll get nice going out, but 9 times out of 10, I'm in a hoodie and sweat, and I'm doing Walmart runs. and I'm at home and I'm cooking and I'm with my kids. So that is my real life. And then my business side is the music when I'm in the studio, when I got to go here, when I got to hustle, when I got, you get what I'm saying? And I think people get too caught up in, I got to be on the yacht or I got to do this or I got to do that. I can go get on the yacht, but that's my leisure time. That's when I want to have fun. I don't have to do that shit to show off for some likes. That's something that I'm doing because I'm enjoying myself. And I just feel like people don't know how to separate it. I don't put other people down if they don't wear.
Right.
I just had some Dolce & Gabbana shoes on. Okay, one time I wore them and they've been in my closet because I'm not that type of person where I got to go out of my and I have to wear this. When I was like 18, 19 and I was running the streets, yeah, I had to fly your cars. I had all my jewelry, but that's not where I'm at. You get what I'm saying?
Right, and people, as we call it in the business, SK, about what everybody be saying, is, and you know this, and you and King know this terminology. It's called being on, and that's the problem with a lot of artists. They feel like they got to be on all the time in terms of this presence, in terms of that act, and so many times they get caught up being on all the time, they can't turn it off. But when you're on
right.
like that all the time, you know, ultimately you can get yourself jammed up. You know, it's too many examples that we've seen where artists got to run in their mouth and something happened to them. Situations we know about, some we don't know about. You know, but
okay.
everybody got to understand, it's okay to be normal. It's okay to have a regular life. It's okay to chill at home and not turn up. You know, I tell everybody, you know, don't let everybody know where you're going to be at. You know, that's how niggas get robbed. You know, I mean, I got jewels, and I don't wear my jewelry every day. It's like, if I go to a function, if I'm going somewhere specific, then yeah, the shit going to be out. But other than that, to just walk around,
yeah, you got a person.
People be out there. Yeah, people, and the thing is, you got to understand, in the most basic greed and envy, people will try to take it off of you just because you have it and they don't, and they want it, and they'll do whatever they got.
Right.
To
Very much so. Very much so. That's so
you
true.
Know.
But
no,
it's how you said people don't know how to turn it off. They, a person to be on so much, you don't know how to turn it off. But that's another thing. You got to be comfortable in your skin. Like I can go hop on the bus right now. Like, I just had a situation where I had to park my car, and I took an L.A. City bus because, well, no, here, you give it to her. Because I'm still doing an interview. Because it was a parking situation. I'm like, fuck it, I'm just going to hop on the bus. And I was comfortable. I was comfortable on the bus. A lot of people, especially in the industry and in the field I'm in, they can't do that. You feel me? Like, it was a time when I had, like, 3 cars, and I would drive. I think I had a Benz, and I had 2 Benzes and another car, and I would never drive them. I'll drive, I think it was like my Ford Taurus. I just drive that everywhere. And I was comfortable. You got to be comfortable. And a person, I'm not saying, oh, well, you got to live a regular life. No, because if you make good money and if you work hard, and you should be able to get the things that you like, the nice things. But it become a problem when you down other people and you look at other people like they not shit because they don't have what you have or because they don't even have a desire to want to get anything like that.
Exactly.
Yeah, that would kill a lot of these artists, man. Especially those niggas that got 200,000 followers and ain't boast about how much bread they have. To see them taking the bus, oh man, they would break their spirit. But at the same time, why would you care?
But that's the thing.
They're so image conscious.
I can, But I have cars. I own my house. I have the shit that I'm supposed to have as a woman. You get what I'm saying? I have, as an independent woman, I've been a homeowner since I was 20-something. So I have the necessities that I need. So if, for instance, I have a very nice car. I'm about to go cop me another one. But, okay, it might be a time where I just want to ride the bus. Or you know what I'm saying? I might just want to go to Walmart and get some flip-flops or some little cheap shoes from Walmart. But I also just spent $600 on some Balenciaga shades. You got to do what you want to do. So if somebody see me in some Walmart flip-flops or a shirt from Walmart, that devalues me because I'm not wearing the shit I just spent a gang of money on. No, that's put up in the closet. I wear it when need be. But that don't devalue me.
Absolutely.
Like, you get what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
I might just pass. Do you get what I'm saying? I might just pass on some shit and got, like, 70 or 80,000 put up. So I got to go buy me a chain because I didn't pass and got some bread? No, that's not what I want. I might just want to go cop me another house. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, we don't have to do what people feel we need to do being in the industry to be on. Everyone is different. That's why you can see J. Cole riding a bicycle. And he's one of the top-selling artists.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you know, this is the thing about it with USK, you paid your dues. So you got your money up. You're good. You know. So anything you do.
Say that again,
is a bonus.
You said what?
I said you got your money up. You're good, you know. Anything you do is a bonus right now because you've been living well for a very long time.
But this is the thing. You can't look at a person and say, because they paid their dues, they got their money. I've made very good money. I've made very, very good money to be an independent artist. But I've also hit rock bottom and lost money, flipping money, putting money in stuff and investments that didn't work out. So hold up. No, I'm an entrepreneur, so I took a lot of losses.
Right.
So, but I've also made money. But you just can't look at a person and say, okay, well, you got your money up. And I think that's the perception, too, because people look at people and see what they're doing and feel like, oh, they got it or that. But you never know. I have friends on TV right now. One of them sleeping in a car, and they're on TV. I have other friends in the industry that I have to lend money to. I would never say their names, but I'm just saying. But if you look at them, you would never think that because it's the perception. And this is why you have suicide.
Right.
This is why you have depression because you're keeping up with the image. Do you think someone that's on TV or that's a top-selling artist and they hit rock bottom, do you think they're going to feel comfortable getting a 9-to-5? No.
And so what do they do? They go into
a depression form. They become depressed because they have this image and they don't know how to walk up out that image and say, fuck this, I got to do what I have to do. Sometimes you got to do what you have to do, not what you want to do, but what you have to do. So,
for instance,
I'm the type of person, if I know I don't have no money coming in and I done did a fucked up investment, I will go get me a job. Back my bread and flip it. Like, I'm that type of person. I will go work. I have no problem with it. A lot of people is not like that, especially being artists or entrepreneurs.
And people have to understand that. People have to understand that in terms of how this industry is. Because one thing about it, and I've said this before on the show, I have every double XL since 1997 from when they started pressing. I have every Source magazine from 1994 when I started reading. And you see a lot of these artists that were there who were big at one point and they're not big anymore. Then you see the artists, you know, who were profiled who were supposed to be the next and they didn't make it. And there's such an emphasis on whatever, like you said, okay, or what everybody thinks that you should be once you get there. But the reality is, a lot of, like you said, the industry is smoke and mirrors. A lot of these people don't have money like everybody thinks that they got money. You know? And I tell anybody, if you do get into a little bit of money where you do get it, don't blow it on a chain or a car. You know, save it. I cannot forget his wisdom that Rick Ross said in his book, you know, Hurricane, when he wrote about when he signed his deal with Def Jam. He said that he did not spend a penny of his advance. He said he ain't spent a penny of that advance. He was like, he went on the road and he started making his money because he's like, I knew I had to make as much as I could at the time I was buzzing because I had to save, you know, because I didn't know what was going to happen. He's like, but I didn't start spending until he, and they said that, and they said the first part, the big purchase, once he had his money up, he said the first big purchase he made, I think, was a condo, his first house.
Okay.
You know, but that was, but everything comes in stages, and that's the biggest thing artists have to understand. You know, first you got to get yourself out there. Then when the money comes in, make sure your investments are good in terms of making sure your money's taken care of. Then after you get a little bit, then you can start buying a little something and buy shit that makes sense, especially from economic wisdom. Your car should never cost more than your house. I say it again. Your car should never cost more than your house.
Very much so. Very much so.
You know.
You know how much information we've been giving in 2 hours. So you're not going to get this type of game on any other show but Off the Cuff Radio. Y'all getting financial literacy. Y'all getting, survival trade. Y'all getting history about our guests. We providing all types of information here. Y'all better subscribe and donate to the channel. Do that for
absolutely. Yeah. You know, but this is something we've been blessed over the years doing this, interviewing people like yourself and so many others. We talk to them on air, you know, off on air, off air, and we get a lot of wisdom. Like I said, King and myself were older, so we understand the game differently from what it is. And one thing is, we want the younger generation to thrive. We want to leave a lesson of literacy, of understanding, of humility, of compassion, of respect for each other, for them to follow. Because at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. If you can help someone, if you can be humble, if you can be nice, be all three. Because you want to leave a legacy of kindness to where people respect you for how you made them feel respecting them rather than being an asshole and how you insulted them. And some people learn that lesson, some don't.
Right, very much so. That's 100% correct.
But we
about to, you know, wind it down. You know, we got about 5 more minutes to spare. This has always been a dope bill. You know.
Absolutely.
On Off the Cuff Radio, the sequels are always better than the first show. You know what I mean? It's a rarity within this show. So you have any shout-outs you want to give out?
For me, nah, not really. I really don't.
Well, you gotta plug your social media handles so way people will know where to find you and where to contact you and find your content.
For sure. They can hit me, they can look at my site, helecia.com, helecia.com. My Instagram is heleciachoice, heleciachoice.
Definitely.
There we go.
Definitely. SK, this has been educational. This has been informative. This has been engaging, riveting, all things substantial and, you know, circumstantial. You know, this is a great consequence. This is a great relevance. We thank you so much again for being with us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Definitely. So on that note, we're about to head up out of here.
Be sure to check us out this Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 Pacific, 8 Central Time. We're going to be doing the free BG episode. So be sure to tune in to that. We're going to be playing a lot of his songs. We're going to be showing love, answering calls from his family, friends, you name it. Free B-Jizzle. And thank you, SKG, for joining us. We definitely love to have you on a part three down the line.
Yep. And on that note, we're about to close shop. And we out. Peace.
Yeah.